From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Coming up on today's program, who will benefit from Michigan's newly expanded Medicaid program?
It provides an option that many low-income Americans don't have at present, and we know that it will both improve their financial well-being as well as certain parts of their health by having more ready access to health care.
Plus, we demystify the debate over Common Core state standards.
The Common Core has broad-based support on the left and on the right.
Also, Sergio Marchionne says Fiat might pull back from Chrysler if the American carmaker goes public.
I think his credibility with the markets and with people who watch the industry is that, in fact, he does this kind of stuff.
But is it all just a bluff? First, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. After months and months of debate, the State House is voting on the Common Core State Standards today, educational standards that have been approved by 45 other states. On today's show, the facts and myths surrounding Common Core, and then Medicaid is being expanded in Michigan. But just who, what types of people will be newly enrolled? A new study has some surprising answers.
Our study was able to show that these individuals are likely to be healthier, or at least as healthy as the current Medicaid population. However, they are going to have a larger proportion of current smokers and a higher proportion of individuals who drink heavily.
But first, White House officials are meeting with Detroit and Michigan officials tomorrow, and the feds are expected to bring some money. It's not being called a Detroit bailout, but it is expected to include federal and private funds to help Detroit demolish abandoned buildings, support the police, and some transportation projects. The Detroit Free Press has been reporting on efforts to leverage as much federal help as possible. Todd Spangler reports for the Freep, and he joins us now. So, Todd, one of the problems Detroit has had in getting grants is not keeping up with the requirements of the grants they do get and having to send money back to Washington. I understand part of this meeting tomorrow at Wayne State University is to help Detroit handle the grant money better and to take advantage of other money that might be available to help without crossing that line of being a bailout. So who's coming and what kind of money are we talking about?
Hi, Lester. In terms of who's coming, I mean, you're going to see the Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox, the HUD Secretary Sean Donovan, as well as Gene Sperling from the National Economic Council, and there'll be other folks coming in from Washington. What they're going to be talking about, basically, is you hit the nail on the head. In terms of actual new money that the Fed's going to be bringing with them, there's not going to be a lot. A lot of this is going to be money that's already been freed up for Detroit. What more of is going to be talked about is improving the city's capacity, its financial systems, its accounting systems, in order to make sure that when this money comes in, it gets spent where it's supposed to be spent, and that you can they can report back to the feds it got spent the way it's supposed to be spent, so you can send more. Because apparently there has been lots of money that's sort of stuck in the pipeline that they can't spend because they can't effectively get it to the projects it needs to be got to.
Right. You've been talking about how the city of Detroit has had this trouble handling and spending the grant money it's received in the past. You mentioned a specific example that emergency manager Kevin Orr talked about dealing with the fire department. Do you want to explain that one?
Well, there are so many different examples in terms of how much. I mean, to center on one is probably not even the right way to go. There are cases where, you know, there was one recently where there was a check for, I believe, $1 million sitting in somebody's, you know, desk drawer in the city of Detroit that emergency manager Orr has talked about. And frankly, I was just talking to Governor Snyder, who's here in town today, in Washington today, about this. You know, that the financial systems, the accounting systems in the city are just abysmal. And there needs to be help with that in order to spend what money the feds are already giving. In terms of what the feds are going to give beyond that, it's not much. I mean, to be honest with you, everyone talks about the federal government spending a lot of money, and it does. It does spend a lot of money. But a lot of that money is spoken for. It's either doled out in competitive bids or grants, or it's doled out on a formulaic basis like community development funds. They can't really dip back in and say, let's give Detroit more, because there's not more to give. So this is going to be more about where can we help Detroit spend what they're already getting.
Right, and Senator Carl Levin's staff has also come up with a list of 200 programs that the Obama administration could use to help Detroit improve its lot. Senator says, I think they're sending in the cavalry, they being the Obama administration's. This is short of a bailout. This is stuff that any city or any municipality in the nation can apply for, but maybe Detroit just hasn't seen or taken advantage of, right?
That's exactly right. The list of 200 or so programs that Senator Levin put together to make sure that the White House was aware of these programs was really done more as a way to draw attention to the fact that there's lots of avenues of help if Detroit would apply for them. It doesn't mean that Detroit's going to get a leg up. I mean, folks from the White House have told me they're constitutionally barred from putting a thumb on the scale in Detroit's favor. They just can't do it in a lot of these funds. But they can make sure that the city knows that fund exists, and by working with maybe some private foundations and things, charitable organizations there in Detroit, maybe those groups can come help put grant applications together and try to get more money flowing out to the city.
I want to talk about politics for a moment. There are those who will call even this approach to take advantage of these grants and programs that anybody can apply for a bailout. They'll try to find political advantage in this. They'll criticize Michigan. They'll criticize Detroit, the Obama administration, the Snyder administration, anyone who touches this, labeling it as handouts, rewarding badly handled finances. There's going to be a political price. How much is that being considered in the big picture?
Well, I think that you've really sort of hit upon what the political, what the calculus here is in Washington, and it's a tricky calculus. The Democrats in Congress, Michigan's congressional delegation, really want to make sure that every avenue is explored in terms of getting aid to Detroit. Republicans, not so much in the delegation, but Republicans overall, particularly in the Senate, have even argued for stopping any kind of aid to Detroit, thinking the money might get wasted or be used in some fashion to stave off a bankruptcy that should happen. The administration's caught between this. The Obama administration has basically said, we're not getting between the creditors and the city. We're not going to show special favoritism for Detroit. But at the same time, we're going to go ahead and make sure they know all of the programs that could help them and do what we can, just as we would probably try to do for any city that went bankrupt.
Now, we assume that there's going to be some money announced tomorrow. Is this likely just to be the first round of new federal funds that have been found, ferreted out for Detroit's use?
Yes and no. The way that's going to really play out is that what you're going to hear about tomorrow, in large measure, I think is going to be about funds that have already been awarded, $100 million from the hardest hit fund that can be used now for demolition across the state. More than $50 million of that in Detroit. That's already been announced. That was announced before even the bankruptcy was filed. That's going to be talked about again as a place where the feds are trying to help Detroit. Transportation money, maybe as much as $100 million in funding that's kind of locked up in that pipeline that I was talking about before. It's already been awarded, but making sure the city can use it and giving them the technical assistance to try to get them to use it. That's a lot of what's going to be talked about here. Will there be more of that in the future? Absolutely. I think also what you're going to hear about tomorrow is maybe another smaller grant here, or smaller grant there, and a lot from the foundations. I think you're going to see something coming out from the private foundations there in Detroit that are going to say, we're going to start adding some money to this, we're going to start adding some technical expertise to this, and we're going to start leveraging these assets that we now are aware of that the federal government has to try to get that money to Detroit.
So this meeting of the Obama administration officials, the mayor, the emergency manager, the governor, congressional delegates, this big meeting is closed to the public. It's closed to the media. When and what are we going to learn from this media and through whom? I mean, without being there, it's a little tough to find out what's actually going on. And, you know, reporters loathe looking at these fancy press releases that were typed up 3 days ago for us.
Right. Well, there is going to be a press availability after this meeting at about shortly after 1 o'clock tomorrow at Wayne State, and this is going to happen at Wayne State. At that, I'm sure that the folks who are there from the president's cabinet, as well as the governor, as well as Kevin Orr, as well as others, will have a chance to step forward and speak about the discussions that were at the meeting and what the federal government is trying to bring to bear to help Detroit. How much they go into it, that press availability, it remains to be seen. This is also going to be a chance, I'm told, for cabinet officials to have some outside meetings with folks from Detroit. I think the transportation secretary is looking at having some sort of bus tour around Detroit, as well as meeting with executives of the big three auto companies. There's been talk about whether or not the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development might try to meet separately with some community leaders. So, I mean, a lot of what's happening at this meeting is about conversation. It's about talking with people, to seeing what can be done, and a lot of that will come out.
Final question. What impact might these new funds have on the ongoing Detroit bankruptcy case?
That is a great question. I think from the beginning, the administration has been very upfront about saying, where they can help. But when it comes to the actual bankruptcy and that litigation, there is very little that they're going to get involved in, if anything. They've clearly said they're not going to get involved in litigation. And not getting involved in that litigation means not getting involved, really, in what the bottom line is for Detroit. Detroit is in a situation, if you look at it from a bankruptcy perspective, where they need to cut the amount of money that they're spending, given what their tax base is. There's not a whole lot that's going to change that. I think that what you're going to hear a lot about is how can they make public safety better to try to attract residents to come back in rather than leave, but how can they help schools to try to keep families there. You're going to hear private, you know, entrepreneurs, Dan Gilbert of Quicken, talk about, you know, how can we get jobs going in Detroit to try to, you know, try to bring people back into the city. Those are longer-term solutions. Those are not short-term bankruptcy solutions. So I don't think that that's going to change that specifically. What you're going to hear tomorrow is about longer-term investments, not short-term.
That's Todd Spangler with the Detroit Free Press. Thanks, Todd.
Hey, thank you very much.
Still to come, there's been lots of confusion over just what the Common Core education standards are. Coming up next, we'll debunk the myths, and then the expansion of Medicaid will bring health care to many new people in Michigan. But just who are these new folks who will be enrolled? The answer might be a bit surprising. That story in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. You might have heard about the Common Core education standards, maybe a bit about the fuss over these new standards. We wanted to get a little more information about what's going on here, so we called up Michael Brickman. He is the National Policy Director at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. That's a conservative education policy think tank. So, Michael, this is the way I'm seeing this. The National Governors Association and the Council of Chief State School Officers got together and they said, hey, we need some benchmarks for how students are doing nationwide because our kids are slipping behind compared to the rest of the industrialized world. So they hire us somebody to come up with some standards. The efforts funded by Bill and Melinda Gates, 45 states approve Common Core. Then the Obama administration say, hey, we're in favor of that. We like those standards. And then suddenly Tea Party members and conservative legislators hate Common Core. Now, I'm oversimplifying a little bit over the last couple of years, but let's start with the basics. What are these Common Core education standards?
Yeah, I think you touched on it. These were standards that were developed by states in response to the fact that following No Child Left Behind's mandate that all students be proficient, states set the bar low enough that people could step over the bar. And unfortunately, that was not being honest with the parents and the community about how schools were doing, how students were doing. And so states got together and said, we need to be honest with our community, with taxpayers, with parents, about how students are doing and whether or not when they graduate and get that piece of paper, their high school diploma, they're actually going to be ready for college or a career or a career in the military or whatever comes next.
Now, I've been reading a lot of articles, and I've been reading a lot of comments at the end of the articles, and there seems to be some concern that a bunch of bureaucrats and a billionaire came up with this. There wasn't enough public input, perhaps too much corporate input. I wonder how you view this.
Well, I don't think that that's accurate. I think if you look into the process of how the standards were developed, and this is prior to the Obama administration jumping on board, like you said, this was developed by people who have knowledge in these content areas. It was developed by experts in math, experts in reading and English language arts. And it was developed with the understanding that students need to be ready for college or career. And so starting early on, we need to set kids on a trajectory for meeting those expectations. And I think it's also worth pointing out that these standards are in many ways very similar to the best of a number of states' standards. So there were a few standards, and if you look at our website, if you just Google the Fordham Institute, we did an evaluation of each state's standards. And take Michigan, for example. Their standards, on the one hand, in math, we graded an A-, which was about on par with the Common Core. But if you look at the English language arts standards for Michigan, they didn't do quite as well. They actually got a D, which was at the bottom end of where many states were. So states looked at this, and even states that had very high quality standards, they saw the benefits of the new standards and the new assessments, and chose to upgrade anyway because they felt that this was going to put their students in a much better position to be globally competitive.
Let's deal with some of the things that have been brought up. Does Common Core reduce the independence of school districts or state education efforts?
Not at all. And I think in many ways just the opposite, because it's important for people to realize states had standards before the Common Core. This is about making sure that there are better standards. So as long as you have an understanding that states have better standards, and further an understanding that standards are not curriculum, they're not pedagogy, they're not telling teachers what to teach in the classroom, they're a set of goals for and targets for students to meet.
You've already touched on one of the other things that's brought up. It doesn't dictate curriculum then. We'll skip through that and get
right to
the next one. Does it water down educational standards somehow?
No, as I mentioned before, these standards are, in the vast majority of states, I think about three-quarters of states, they're much higher than the standards states had before. And they also allow for other benefits like comparability, simplicity, so teachers actually understand what the expectations are and can use their creativity, their insight, and their skills to make sure that each and every student has an individualized education tailored to their goals, their abilities, and their challenges, and ultimately can be ready for college and career upon graduation.
Looking at your website, it's pretty clear that you are in favor of careful implementation of Common Core education standards. You're a conservative think tank. What are your conservative friends missing here?
Well, I think that we're always concerned about a federal intrusion into local and state issues when it comes to education. And there are certainly real examples of that. Look at the Louisiana voucher issue that's going on right now, where the Department of Justice has come in and tried to deny low-income students the right to a high-quality education. That's a real issue. That's a real federal intrusion. The Common Core is not, and I think people need to understand that. Look past the fact that, you know, even though Obama's supporting it, just about everybody's supporting it, from the business community, from teachers, from education researchers, the Common Core has broad-based support and on the left and on the right. And so beyond the process, beyond the politics, once people actually look at what the standards are, what they do, and how they're improvement over Michigan standards or most other state standards, they really get on board. And Michigan, for example, there's a poll that just came out that showed not only a majority of all people in Michigan, not only a majority of all Michigan Republicans, but actually a majority of Michigan self-identified Tea Partiers support the Common Core. So this is something that has very broad-based support. There's a vocal minority that has some concerns, but I think they'll come around in time.
All right. Michael Brickman is National Policy Director at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. We've been talking about Common Core education standards. Thanks for helping us understand this better.
Thanks for having me on.
As of this afternoon, the State House adopted the implementation of Common Core standards. The vote was 85 to 21. It now goes to the Senate. Michigan's Medicaid expansion has a number of conditions demanded by the Republicans and accepted by the Democrats in the legislature. One medical expert says Michigan's Medicaid expansion could be a model for other Republican-held states that so far have not approved Medicaid expansion. It's a key component for the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Dr. John Ayenian is the new head of the University of Michigan's Institute for Healthcare Policy and Innovation. He made that statement in an article published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and he joins us now. So let's start with some basics. The Medicaid expansion in Michigan will cover more than 400,000 more people, mostly low-income working people, starting next year. Why do you believe Michigan's approach to expanding and reforming Medicaid might be something Republican-dominated legislatures in other states would want to follow?
The state legislature and the governor here in Michigan have taken a bipartisan approach that combines Republican principles about introducing more responsibility and market-oriented reforms in the healthcare system, along with the Democratic priority of extending insurance coverage to more low-income Americans who can't afford coverage that's either available through their employers or not available at all to them.
Now, one of the real concerns by the Republicans was when the federal government starts pulling back some of the Medicaid expansion funding, which happens in about 3 years. What has Michigan done to temper that concern that the state would be left holding the bag?
By accepting the expansion of Medicaid and the federal funds that come with that, in fact, the federal government will cover all of the costs through 2016 and then reduce their contribution to 95% in 2017. The state will be saving money on other health care programs that it currently funds, such as mental health programs or prison health programs, as well as the premiums that the state is paying for its own employees for the private insurance coverage that they have. So by saving those dollars with the additional Medicaid support from the federal government, Governor Snyder and the legislature are saving the funds for future years when the state will be expected to contribute some of the costs of the Medicaid expansion, and ensuring that the state does not bear any extra costs for the additional coverage that will be provided to Michigan residents.
Right. As I understand it, the bill says basically, hey, if we don't save money on this, we're pulling out.
That's right. And it requires an agreement or waiver from the federal government to allow the state to do that. But my expectation is that the state will work closely with the federal government to make that happen.
There's a cost-sharing component in this expansion. How does that work?
So this is a feature that's been tried in some states in Medicaid and will be part of the expansion here in Michigan. So for individuals who enroll in the Medicaid program, those living just above the federal poverty level, about $15,000 a year for a single adult, they'll be expected to contribute up to 5% of their income towards the costs of their health care through co-payments that people commonly make in private insurance plans as well.
Healthy behaviors will also be rewarded. I'm wondering, what does that mean and how will they be rewarded? Are we going to have to get on the treadmill? It will be monitored every day? Or how do we go about doing that?
Initially, the new enrollees in Medicaid will be asked to submit a survey basically reporting on their health habits, for example, whether they smoke, whether they exercise, what immunizations they've had. That information will allow their doctors and other health care providers to serve them better and provide the appropriate preventive services. And so by reporting that information about their health behaviors, they'll be eligible for reductions in the co-payments that they're expected to pay. They can actually be reduced from 5% to 2% if they participate in promoting more healthy behaviors in their own health care.
It's like a government subsidy for being healthy. Sounds like.
Well, it's something that employers and private insurers are promoting as a way for all of us to be more healthy and to prevent some of the complications of conditions like diabetes or high blood pressure that can be very costly.
There's a component in Michigan's Medicaid expansion that encourages private sector insurance. What's the tipping point for the working poor person who will have the option of Medicaid? What's the incentive to move them to private insurance?
Well, the law is written to give those who become eligible for Medicaid the option after 4 years of switching to a private insurance plan through the state health insurance exchange that's being launched on October 1st. I believe that the goal is to provide more choice for those enrollees in the Medicaid program, as well as have a more balanced combination of public and private insurance in the state.
Do you really think the remaining states who have not expanded Medicaid so far, mostly Republican-led, will actually look to Michigan? And if not, what happens as Obamacare rolls out?
Well, in fact, there are four Republican-dominated states where Republicans hold the governor's office and the legislature, that are relatively close to Michigan: Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, and Tennessee. And I believe the model that Michigan has established for Republicans and Democrats working together to look for a middle ground that satisfies the Democratic priority of extending coverage to low-income residents, as well as some Republican goals of introducing more individual responsibility and strategies to contain health care costs using the health care market and the private sector, is a combination that could be grounds for bipartisan compromise in those other states that are still considering the Medicaid expansion.
And if they don't, are we just going to see a lot of people not covered or only have the option of more expensive private sector insurance off the exchanges?
That's the major concern. So the low-income adults who typically are not covered by Medicaid prior to the Affordable Care Act either work for firms that don't offer health insurance or their incomes are too low to afford it. So by enrolling them in Medicaid, it does not cause them to bear any premiums, but in the Michigan law will have some out-of-pocket costs for the services they use. It provides an option that many low-income Americans don't have at present, and we know that it will both improve their financial well-being as well as certain parts of their health by having more ready access to health care.
That's John Iannion. He's the author of the article Michigan's Approach to Medicaid Expansion and Reform, published in the New England Journal of Medicine. He heads up the University of Michigan Institute for Healthcare Policy and Innovation. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Now, as we look toward Medicaid expansion, we're starting to get a better picture of who'll be covered. Much of Medicaid now is spent on people in nursing homes, but the expansion will include a lot of younger people, some low-income workers. A new study from the University of Michigan Medical School looks at the likely demographics, and joining us now is Tammy Chang, the lead author of that study. So what will these new people entering Medicaid coverage look like?
These new enrollees under expansion to Medicaid are going to have a higher proportion of males. There's going to be more white Americans, and on average, they're going to be younger.
And I understand some of them are going to have some bad habits, too. That's the flip side of it.
Right. So our study was able to show that these individuals are likely to be healthier, or at least as healthy as the current Medicaid population. However, they are going to have a larger proportion of current smokers and a higher proportion of individuals who drink heavily.
So because of these habits or behaviors, it sounds as though a lot of these health issues that they'll be facing might be preventable. How will that play out in the approach to keep them healthy and avoid costs in the future?
That's a really great point, because Medicaid expansion really represents a key opportunity to engage these healthier individuals to keep them healthy, address some prevention issues, as well as deal with these health behavior issues.
The whole idea of this is to lower the health care costs, make sure everybody can get insurance of one kind or another, or will have to get insurance of one kind or another. What will it do to the demographics as we add these younger, whiter folks into the Medicaid population? And how does that compare to the Medicaid population now?
They're really quite different populations. Medicaid as a program now is a program that people think of as something that serves very low-income individuals, pregnant women, children, disabled individuals. And this population that we're finding that's going to be newly enrolling is going to look very different. They're going to be younger. They're going to be as healthy, if not healthier. And there's going to be a lot of opportunity for physicians and policymakers to create programs to keep them healthy.
I guess this is all about cost. So how will this affect the projected cost of Medicaid to the federal government? As in some states, it's taking the whole cost of that on as the expansions take place. And in the future to states as they start paying part of that cost of expansion in a few years.
So the national estimates for the cost of Medicaid expansion is based on the health of the current enrollees. And because our study shows that many of these individuals who will be enrolling now have less chronic disease, providing health care for these individuals is likely going to have lower than expected costs.
There are going to be new requirements to be eligible for Medicaid. How do they differ from before? And how are they going to reach out to people who aren't even aware that they are eligible?
There's a lot of confusion about that, and I'm glad that you asked, because one of the biggest problems with this population is we don't know if these individuals even know that they qualify for Medicaid. So Medicaid criteria in the past required that you have a very, very low income, and now the cutoffs are going to be much higher, so 138% of the federal poverty level.
We're talking about the working poor then now at this point.
Right.
So we've seen some states indicate that the Affordable Care Act is actually going to be cheaper to implement than previously thought, as you mentioned before. Cheaper than the forecast doesn't mean cheaper overall. What are the predictions these days? I mean, we've got this, we'll have the health care insurance mandate, we'll have the expanded Medicaid. We are going to see some people enrolled who have not been on any kind of insurance program in the past. But are we going to see health care costs and health care premiums actually go down?
I wish I could give you an answer, especially based on our study. It's going to take a lot of enrolling of the healthy individuals to get what we call a patient population that includes these healthy individuals as well as people who need a lot of health care. We don't know who's going to sign up right now. I think that these projections are, you know, it would be great for me to make a guess, but we're not going to be able to know, unfortunately. These next few months are going to be very exciting. I think there's a lot of power that individuals have to take advantage of health care now that is going to be much more affordable. And I think that's really the focus. That should be the focus.
Tammy Chang, along with Matthew Davis, wrote the study, Potential Adult Medicaid Beneficiaries Under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act Compared with Current Adult Medicaid Beneficiaries. It was published in the Annals of Family Medicine. Thanks for coming in and telling us about it.
Thank you, Lester.
It's Still to come, the focus right now is on a possible government shutdown. Then there's the other debate about the debt ceiling. But whatever happened to the sequester? Remember that? Well, in 10 minutes, we'll talk to a judge who says the across-the-board federal cuts are impacting justice in Michigan and across the country. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Well, without a doubt, the automakers of Detroit are healthier these days. But in the midst of better cars and trucks and much better sales are some machinations within Chrysler. When Fiat, led by Sergio Marchionne, allied itself with Chrysler, it seemed to solve problems for both companies. But Marchionne has a rocky relationship with Chrysler workers represented by the United Auto Workers. Now, Chrysler's retiree healthcare trust is offering a placeholder $100 million worth of shares and a filing for an initial public offering in the U.S. They want to take Chrysler public. That really messes with Marchionne's plans to merge Chrysler and Fiat. Detroit News columnist Daniel Howes wrote about that today and joins us now. So, Daniel, what's at stake here?
Well, I think what's at stake is control of Chrysler. This is the fourth time in 15 years that there's a battle, essentially, for the control and ownership of Chrysler. Interesting that this time the question is being called initially by the UAW's healthcare trust, which I think wisely recognizes that it's not smart to have all of its assets tied up in stock in Chrysler that it cannot liquidate and diversify. So they're pushing ahead to try and get Marchionne to sell some of this through an IPO. Marchionne doesn't want to do that. What he wants to do is negotiate with them privately for an agree on a price and then acquire the entire remaining stake in Chrysler, unify the company, Fiat Chrysler, and then reissue and then IPO the shares of the combined transatlantic company on one stock exchange. As it would stand now, you would have two different stock exchanges, and then you could have other people that could get in the mix that could buy chunks of the company. This clearly is not what he wants, but so I think he's essentially calling the question on Bob King as a president. I think I would amend one point you made. I think it's his relationship is rocky with the president of the UAW more than it is with the workers per se.
So this is personal animosity between Marchionne and King, it sounds like.
Yeah, I either animosity or it's just this is the way he does things. As I point out in the column today, this is the same guy that ended up getting $2 billion cash payment out of pre-bankrupt General Motors to wind down the relationship that Fiat had with GM in the 2000s, and he's also the guy that got control of Chrysler from the feds for essentially no money down.
Tough negotiator, then.
He's a tough negotiator, and he did it with Bob King in 2011 in the contract talks. So I don't think we can take any of this lightly. On the other hand, it's a little disingenuous on the part of Fiat to say, well, if Chrysler does this, then we're going to renegotiate or rethink our relationship with them, as if to suggest that we will get out of the relationship. Chrysler is the only thing that is generating cash for Fiat right now. They need Chrysler desperately, and Chrysler needs Fiat for purchasing synergies and global footprint and a distribution system outside of North America that is effective.
I understand what you're saying, but there's still these veiled threats, it seems like. Could Fiat actually drop the Chrysler Alliance if the pensioners pursue this IPO?
Well, I think a lot of us that know this situation are very skeptical about that. So some of us, I think, look at this and say this is a bit of a hollow threat. However, Marchionne is not somebody who takes these kinds of things lightly and throws this stuff around. I think his credibility with the markets and with people who watch the industry is that, in fact, he does this kind of stuff, or he takes a more aggressive bargaining stances and essentially is trying, in this case, I think he's trying to stare him down. A lot of people think, and I think this is probably right, that this is a precursor to actually agreeing on a price privately outside of the markets, and which they can do up until the time that they actually issue the shares.
If Chrysler were to go public, shareholders would hold a minority stake, as you point out in your column.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of control would they have over the company?
Well, I think as a general proposition, you don't have a lot of control. If you're a major shareholder, you can probably cause trouble. But clearly, I think the thing we need to remember here is would this be in the best interest of Chrysler and its employees and its retirees if, in fact, you get into a very muddled situation that is potentially antagonistic Is that really what they need? I mean, they do need, on the other hand, they do have an obligation. The UAW's healthcare trust has an obligation to get the highest price they can for their shares. I think part of what Marchione's argument is in filing for the IPO is that because it would be a muddled picture, it's more likely that those shares go out into the public and they fetch a lower price in the marketplace than they would in a private negotiation. So essentially he's saying to the UAW, do you really want to roll the dice here on how this could play in the marketplace versus what we are able to negotiate with you? Now, of course, the UAW's financial advisors at this point think that the stake is valued higher than he says it is, but that doesn't mean that's where the market's going to value it.
All right. Hey, I want to switch topics on you. I want to ask you about the Detroit bankruptcy filing and the emergency manager, Kevin Orr. There's been a flap about Orr's fancy hotel room and travel expenses. Mm-hmm. Turns out the Snyder, somewhat secretive nerd fund is paying for the hotel room and travel expenses for Orr to fly back home. Well, there are some questions about who's paying those bills. So if some donors to the nerd fund are paying for the hotel room, why do we care as long as Detroit taxpayers are not paying for it?
I don't think we should. Frankly, and I think that one of the sideshows of this bankruptcy is the series of sideshows. We kind of careen from one tangential flap to the next, and this is just the latest. And who's paying the bills? Who's paying the bills? Well, the taxpayers aren't paying it, so I mean that's I think a positive. Having said that, you know, I think the NERD fund is a potential liability for the governor, particularly as he's going to get ready to crank up and go into a reelection campaign. And our editorial page at the Detroit News and others, and I think I'd put myself in that camp, think that they have to think very seriously about just if they say they have nothing to hide, then show you have nothing to hide. Put the names out there, say who your donors are, and move on.
But in these days of super PACs, I mean, this is not an extraordinary move.
No, it's not. But remember, there have been other kinds of PACs in the state of Michigan and in Detroit that have gotten into other kinds of things that are, let's just say, less savory. So I think that's part of the problem here. But, you know, to your initial question, no, I really don't think it is a problem. But I think the governor and his people need to think about whether just coming clean on this and kind of adding credibility to their contention that they have nothing to hide is probably the smarter move, and I would be surprised if they don't do that.
Orr says he's paying his own travel expenses. There seems to be some controversy there. Do we know if that's true?
Well, I think part of what I've read, he says he's paying certain of his food bills, and he's paying for a portion of his air travel. Now, I'm not quite sure how that all nets out. We've seen different accounts on this from his spokesman and from other people, but I think net-net, it's a tempest in a teapot. And, you know, I think people need to focus on some of the really serious issues here and not some of these ancillary things that are just trying to discredit somebody. I mean, it's a lot better that the city's not paying these bills than anybody else.
All right. Daniel Howes is the business columnist for Detroit News and joins us regularly on Stateside. Thanks, Daniel.
Thanks a bunch.
Many of us might not really have noticed the sequestration cuts by Congress, but they are being felt. One place, within the federal court system. 87 judges have signed a letter outlining the problems caused by the cuts, and they've sent that letter to Congress. One of the judges who signed that letter is the chief judge for the United States District Court of Eastern District of Michigan, Gerald Rosen, and he joins us now. Judge Rosen, how much money are we talking about, and how significant is that compared to your overall budget?
Well, nationwide, the cuts are dramatic. They're about $350 million overall across the board for court programs. Looking here at home in the Eastern District of Michigan, for fiscal 2013, we have experienced about a $2 million absolute cut. And that translates in a number of different ways, Lester.
Now, I wanted to talk about some of the services and programs that have been cut. What's it mean?
Well, let's start with employees. Employees for the court are provided through various formula in each area. For example, in the probation department, in the pretrial services department, in the clerk's office. And it's based upon volume, largely upon volume, which reflects the need. So we are down, court-wide, we are down about 63 employees from our formula allotment. And our caseload is not down. Our caseload, in fact, at least in the criminal area, our caseload is actually up. So what this means, Lester, is we're actually trying to do more with less resources. And that, of course, spreads everybody thin. I'll talk just about one area to begin with because it really impacts public safety. And that's the area of providing funding for our pretrial services officers and our probation officers. As you probably know, Lester, we supervise offenders both before they are in trial or before they plead guilty or before they're acquitted. And then we supervise them when they come out of prison and are integrating back into the community. And in order to supervise them, we have a number of different tools. We use things like drug testing. We use things like drug treatment, monitors, tethers, mental health counseling. In the case of sex offenders, we use predictive testing to determine whether they pose a risk to society. I should add parenthetically that it's much less expensive to supervise an offender pre-trial and after they come out rather than putting them in the penitentiary or after they come out, putting them back into prison.
Do you think the members of Congress are aware of these kinds of consequences, this increase in the risk to the public?
Well, that's certainly why we wrote our letter, and I was one of the drafters of the letter along with the chief judge of the Southern District of New York and several other chief judges around the country. We wanted to help our colleagues in the legislative branch understand what the impact of their funding cuts were. So let's talk about on the ground what it costs. In order to supervise an offender in the community, it costs about $3,400 a year. In order to supervise somebody and detain them, if you put them on bond, the cost of that is anywhere from $21,000 a year with minimal supervision all the way to $34,000 a year for maximum security. Obviously, that's a huge difference. But beyond the costs, there are many benefits to having offenders in the community. First, they can integrate back with their families. They can earn money. They can support their families. If they're preparing for trial before, during pretrial, it's much easier for them and for their lawyers to prepare their defense. Post-trial, it's an important step into reintegrating back into the community and back into their family to have them with their family. And all of these tools that I've talked about, the drug testing, the monitors, the mental health treatment, halfway houses, all of these tools are what we used to ensure that these folks are not lapsing back into dangerous conduct.
Let's talk about the other side of the coin here. Are there cuts in funds providing lawyers for those who cannot afford one?
Well, that was what I wanted to talk about next, and the answer to that is yes. The federal defenders who represent indigent criminal defendants, their budget in 2013 was cut 10%. The proposed cuts for fiscal 2014 was another 23% on top of that. And we, of course, called that out in our letter to Congress. Again, this is another of these penny-wise and pound-foolish sorts of cuts. Because obviously there's a constitutional right for a defendant to have a lawyer. So indigent defendants are required to have counsel. If we don't have sufficient federal defenders, then they have to be what we call paneled out. They have to be represented by private lawyers who it costs a lot more, even though we pay them at very, very low hourly rates. It costs a lot more than simply paying the salary of a federal defender who's already on the federal salary rolls.
One of the big cases we think about when we think about the federal court in the Eastern District is the Detroit bankruptcy case. Are these sequester cuts going to have an effect on something like that?
I hope not. You know, we've been very good so far at absorbing the cuts that we've had to absorb. As I said, in fiscal 13, it's about $2 million through attrition and through other cuts that we've been able to make and efficiencies such as shared services among our court units. In fact, we're sharing services. You asked about the Detroit bankruptcy. We're sharing some services with the bankruptcy court, which we hope will realize some efficiencies. So I'm hopeful that it would not affect such a major case as the Detroit bankruptcy. But it's going to affect our ability to handle all cases eventually. We've had to cut back in the clerk's office on personnel, so it will cut back on efficiency.
Given the atmosphere in Congress right now, how optimistic are you that this letter from federal judges will even be noticed?
Well, I'd like to say I'm optimistic, but I'm not. You know, and maybe to understand why, you have to understand how small our budget really is. People have, you know, we are the third branch of government. We're a co-equal branch under the Constitution to the other branches, but yet our budget is less than 0.2%. Putting it another way, for every $100 that's spent, we spend about 19 cents. But our budget is very small. Members of Congress tend to think of us not as a co-equal branch of government, but as a small agency. And
you need better lobbyists.
Yeah, we do. We need better lobbyists. Unfortunately, we don't have much of a constituency. You know, we're not able to do the things that other lobbyists do. We are, of course, by the canons of codes of conduct, precluded from engaging in any kind of political activity, including, of course, fundraising. So we're not really a recognized constituency in that sense, in that we don't participate in the political process. But the courts, our little piece of the budget, feels the impact of the sequestration cuts disproportionately.
Right. Gerald Rosen is the Chief Judge of the United States District Court in Eastern District of Michigan. He is one of the signatories, along with 86 other judges, who signed a letter outlining the problems caused by sequestration, and they sent that to Congress. Good luck with that.
Thank you very much, Lester. Thanks for having me on.
Here at Stateside, we want to hear from you. What's on your mind? What stories do you want to hear more about? Let us know. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. Find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And we're also on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe. Wait, there's an update. Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Alex Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, and Katie Suha. The program is a production of Michigan Radio, the broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty, Cindy is back at the mic on Monday. Thanks so much for listening.